Good morning.
Good morning.
I didn't know who all would be here, but I was thinking about James the 6th and 1st before I came, and I thought, well, maybe I should, you know, just recap his life briefly. So James, right, he had the best education possible, as we talked probably, what, 6 weeks ago, 8 weeks ago. He's said to be the wisest fool in Christendom. He was very, very learned man. he had no parents, though. Right? He had Mary. He had biological parents, Mary Queen of Scots, but she left the country never to return before he was a year old. And his father, of course, had been murdered. Reputedly by his mother, or by her lover. And the fact that he had no parents, he was very sort of undisciplined in some respects. Well, he did learn to be disciplined in a few manners. He learned to be very disciplined when lying to people. He had several occasions where he had to really sort of act one way and pretend one way while really plotting out some kind of strategy. He craved love and found it, as it were, in men. So from early on, he had all these string of homosexual favorites. I don't intend to recount the history of each one, but at the same time, Christianity was sort of I'd call it an intellectual matter for him. I mean, he wouldn't. He wouldn't be like many today who say have no interest and couldn't tell you anything about the Bible. In fact, he knew quite a bit about it. And at times, even he spoke very highly of, say, the practices of the church, the Scottish Church, and so on. Other times, he was determined to get control of it by appointing bishops. I think someone asked, maybe it was Mike. Can't remember, but
was it about interns?
No, it wasn't about interns. Someone had asked why he didn't just go along to get along a little better with the church, and it's still, very unclear. It would have been a lot. He could have, in many respects, made his life a lot easier if he had not worried so much about the church, about trying to get control of it. You know, he could have just kind of gone along with it and probably enjoyed the support of the people a lot better than he did. But he's certainly very conscious of public opinion, Mike. So they didn't have polls, but they did have things approaching that. In fact, we'll see sort of the last thing that he approves, which is an act very favorable to the church. It turns out that part of the reason was political, because there were some other things going on, and he couldn't sort of afford, as it were, politically to veto this act. So, okay, well, I'd like to start, cover a little bit of ground from last week. Just the sort of things I picked up right on the last couple of events I picked up on the end. So I mentioned in 1587 there was this Act of Parliament, the Act of Annexation, and the Parliament passed an act and annexed most of the church's possessions, most of the sort of bishops' possessions, as it were, and I mean with some exceptions such as the manses and some of the tithes and so on, but the large estates and so on that were theoretically owned by the church were annexed to the crown. In other words, they were nationalized, as it were. So for about 30 years, the church had been claiming, since 1560, that these were its possession. And I don't know that they'd continuously argued strongly, but they had this plan that the earnings would go to the diaconal and needs of the church, and also to the educational needs of the church, or you could say the educational needs of the state, because they would essentially been educating everybody with this plan. Okay, but they hadn't gotten anywhere with that argument. And in a sense, this act sort of closed the door on the church's argument. It did have a silver lining. McCree says it's a measure which paved the way for the abolition of episcopacy. It virtually divested the bishops of their right to sit on the national judicature, which was founded on their baronial possessions, and consequently removed the principal plea upon which the court hitherto upheld them in opposition to the unequivocal and decided sentiments of the church. Existing solely by the favor of the prince and dreading the entire suppression of their order, the bishops silently acquiesced in a measure which stripped them of such valuable possessions and left them exposed to the persevering attacks of their adversaries. You know, now, they didn't really have much choice at this point, because, in fact, by now, the bishops were, for the most part, these Tulcan bishops that just had... took a salary, basically, while some noble actually took most of the money from the benefice. Hetherington said it was a fatal blow to the order of bishops, rendering the subsequent endeavors of James and his successors to restore them to their pristine dignity and authority utterly hopeless. So as long as they didn't have this property, then it was difficult for them to sort of maintain themselves in this princely fashion that they had. There's some evidence, I don't know that it's significant or not, that the ministers actually originated this plan. In any case, that there was sort of a, you know, well, in one sense it would have been ideal for the church to keep it. As we've seen politically, that never happened. So, actually, the issue doesn't completely go away. It returns later when James starts more seriously trying to appoint bishops. Okay, and I noted this as I was reading the Act of Annexation, and so if you were wondering about kingcraft or politics in the 16th century, I thought you might appreciate this quote. "And His Highness, for the great love and favor which he bears to his subjects, being no ways minded to grieve them with importable taxations, especially for his royal support, it is found most meet and expedient that he shall have recourse to his own patrimony disposed of before." In other words, when they took back all these lands and stuff, the crown, he was saying so he wouldn't have to tax his subjects. And it was because he had such great love and favor for his subjects. So, does that sound like some kind of present day situation, Mike? About this time, actually next year, 1588, start to see some. The church in England starts to seriously critique the Scottish church, or at least the bishops in the English church. And probably in 1587 it wasn't all that important, but later this is the sort of line that James took when he became King of England also. And there was a Dr. Bancroft, an aspiring ecclesiastic. He preached a sermon to Parliament when they met. And just to give you an idea, this is McCree's description of this. He said, "All the topics of declamation calculated to excite prejudice are carefully collected and employed with no small art. Puritanism is the offering of a spirit of pride, ambition, covetousness, and insubordination. Puritans are coupled with the worst heretics in ancient or modern times. All those writings which contain sentiments less favorable to monarchical government, whether published in Britain or on the continent, are imputed to them. The jealousy of the queen is aroused by representing them as enemies to her supremacy. The nobility are alarmed by being told that the recovery of abbey lands was aimed at. And the gentry and commons are frightened with the inquisitorial powers of the Presbyterian discipline. All are warned to avoid such pests to society, and magistrates are called on to use their authority to restrain and punish them." This is a quote here. "If they, the puritanical geese and dogs, will gaggle and make a noise in the daytime without any cause, I think it very fit that they be wrapped in the shins." That's a quote from the sermon that he preached. Okay, and then, not contented with exposing the evils of Presbyterian in the way of general argument and with confuting such as maintained it in England, the author of the sermon makes a direct and willful attack on the government and discipline of the Church of Scotland. The reformer, whom the Scots held in veneration, is stigmatized as a man of contentious humor and perverse behavior. Knox did have a pretty good sense of humor, but I don't think he had any kind of perverse behavior. And an odious picture, borrowed from the distorted representations of Adamson and Brown, is given of the proceedings of the ministers and church courts in Scotland during their late dissensions with the court. They took it upon them to alter the laws of the land without the consent of the king and estates, threatened them with excommunication, filled the pulpits with seditious and treasonable doctrine, utterly disclaimed the king's authority, trod upon his scepter, labored to establish an ecclesiastical tyranny of an infinite jurisdiction, such as neither the law of God nor man could tolerate, which was the mother of all faction, confusion, sedition, and rebellion, and an introduction to Anabaptism and popularity. Okay, instead of one pope and some lord bishops in name, they had set up 1,000 worldly tyrants who disclaimed the name. Okay, I think it gives you an idea of the sort of sentiment, not of the whole English church, or even of, say, the whole parliament or the Privy Council in England, but at least the sort of one perspective of, say, the Scottish church, or the English church hierarchy on A, Puritanism, right, which was very popular in Scotland, or in England, and B, Presbyterianism, which, of course, had reached sort of its highest fulfillment or establishment to date in Scotland. So, anyways, this becomes more of an issue later on. The Scottish divines actually decided not to reply formally. There were some informal, there was individual responses that were published, but no sort of formal pronouncement from the church. Okay, and let's see, we mentioned the Spanish Armada last week, right? Now, the sort of great concern leading up to that. Let's see, in 1588, James was busy commenting on the Apocalypse, on Revelation, and demonstrating by arguments drawn from that book that the Pope was Antichrist, while Jesuits and seminary priests were seducing his subjects from their allegiance and preparing them for revolt on the first appearance of a foreign force. So, you know, he was sort of fiddling while Rome burned, so to speak, or was getting ready to burn. Andrew Melville, who was then moderator of the General Assembly, called a special meeting of the Assembly basically to consult on how best to meet the need of the hour. And you might recall that this Assembly was actually a violation of the Black Acts of 1584. The Assembly divided up into barons, burgesses, and ministers to sort of consider what they should do. And they came up with, I guess, a report with some findings, and they approached the king with this report, and they offered him, or they made an offer of their lives and fortunes in order to defend the kingdom. So James I was irritated by this for interfering with his government, and also because you might consider this an implicit rebuke if he'd been doing his job, which that's one thing James typically didn't do, was his job. You know, he would have dealt with this earlier. But then he apparently thought better of his attitude. He thanked them, and he established a committee with the Privy Council to meet with them. And so one of the outcomes was a solemn bond of allegiance and mutual defense, approved by His Majesty and zealously promoted by the minister of His Church, was sworn by all ranks. In this, they protested that the Reformed religion and His Majesty's estate had the same friends and foes, and engaged that they would defend and maintain them against all plots and preparations, foreign or domestic, and particularly the threatened invasion, that they would assist in the discovery of Jesuits and other vassals of Rome, that they would assemble at His Majesty's command and hazard their lives, lands, and goods in resisting the common enemy, and that they would lay aside all private feuds and submit every difference that might arise among them in the meantime to the judgment of arbiters to be chosen by the king. And the Armada, as it turns out, I mean, it was a real threat, of course. It was destroyed, I guess, partly by the English Navy and partly by Providence storms. But that didn't end these sort of Spanish and Catholic plots. On the 27th of February, 1589, a packet of letters was intercepted that implicated a number of the Catholic nobles in a plot to land 6,000 troops, Spanish troops, in Scotland. And in the aftermath, James eventually led an army. I guess he led an army. He was a real coward, too. there is a story where a scuffle breaks out behind him, and the swords are drawn, and the two guys go at it. He jumps into the nearest shop, which turns out to be a tannery, where to his great embarrassment, he fouls his britches. That was him writing. But actually, what I would guess is call an unexpected outcome of the Spanish Armada scare was there was some improvement in the relationship between the king and the church. So much so that when he left, on the 22nd October 1589, he sailed for Norway with the purpose of marrying Princess Anne of Denmark. He appointed a minister, Robert Bruce. Do we know any Robert Bruces? I don't know. Is this the Robert Bruce that our Robert Bruce is named after? There's a lot of Robert Bruces in Scotland, and some of them are scoundrels. So, but anyways, he was made an extraordinary member of the Privy Council, so he helped rule the kingdom while he was gone. And indeed, while he was gone, there was a sort of a remarkable season of peace. If you'll recall from some of our past stories, at this point, there wasn't much of a justice system in Scotland. There were a lot of feuds. A lot of things were just settled by personal vendetta. But actually, the kingdom enjoyed a remarkable period of peace while he was gone. Or maybe there's another reason why. Okay, so when he came back with this bride, he was apparently very appreciative of the service rendered by Robert Bruce. He called him his trusty and well-beloved counselor, who said he was worth a quarter of the kingdom. And in fact, James got quite carried away with himself. There's a famous, pretty famous quote. This is after the Sabbath, after the coronation of the queen. He attended a sermon and made a harangue to the people. Okay, this is, I guess, not the harangue in the negative connotation that we might think of, in which he thanked them and the ministers for their conduct during his absence, confessed that the affairs of the kingdom had hitherto been ill-administered, and promised to exert himself in the correction of all abuses. And at the next meeting of the General Assembly, sort of repeated himself, he lamented the bloody feuds which disgraced the country, exhorted the ministers to embrace every opportunity of impressing their hearers with the enormity of such crimes. Okay, and this is where he has this sort of famous, McCree calls it a panegyric, on the purity of the Church of Scotland. He praised God that he was born in such a time as in the time of the light of the gospel, and in such a place as to be king in such a kirk, the purest kirk of the world. And then this is a direct quote from what James said. The kirk of Geneva keepeth Pasch and Yule, Easter and Christmas. What have they for them? They have no institution. As for our neighbor kirk in England, their service is an evil said mass in English. They want nothing of the mass but the liftings. I charge you, my good people, ministers, doctors, elders, nobles, gentlemen and barons, to stand to your purity, and I forsooth, so long as I brook my life and crown, shall maintain the same against all deadly. The creed goes on to say, whether James was on this occasion seized with a sudden fit of devotion and of affection for his mother church, or whether he merely adopted this language to gain the favor of the ministers, may admit of a doubt. But, there is a little bit of evidence, at least intellectually, that James, from time to time, was sort of proud of the Church of Scotland, even though many times he was at odds with them. So. It didn't seem to last very long, though. Okay, in 1591, then, but actually this the sort of a period of where the church got he got along reasonably well with the church did go on for several years, where he wasn't terribly at odds with them. Well, and some of this is said to be due to his counselor. Maitland of Thirlestane, who's the, if you recall this guy Maitland, who was Mary's advisor. This was his younger brother. And I've been reading Maurice Lee's biography of Thirlestane, and I think his basic view is that Maitland was, he was an Erastian, but he was saw it in the king's best interest is to sort of be at peace with the church. So this is probably one case where he had, in that sense, a fairly good counselor. Thirlestane also did quite a bit to sort of help fix the justice system and so on, but apparently he advised him that he needed to try to work harder to be at peace with the church. So okay, anyways, in 1591 there was a minor conflict between the church and state, which I probably wouldn't even bring up if we didn't have as our theme the two kingdoms. A guy named Graham of Halyards, he had gotten a notary public to authenticate a forged document. this was to get some, or in order to defraud the Feuers, in other words, the long-term tenants, of some property belonging to his wife. Okay, the notary, this notary public was then imprisoned, and when he was there, he was visited by a minister. He confessed to the minister that indeed he was guilty of this forgery, you know, authenticating it. And of course, that didn't, that said he was guilty, but that also said this Graham of Halyards was guilty. So Graham accused the minister of convincing the notary to lie. Okay, so we now have at this point, there's a civil case with this forged instrument and the notary having assisted in the forgery. And then there's also a church case with the this minister being accused of suborning perjury, if you will. So the church actually took up the case, well, it was actually going through the civil court system, the court of session, and the church took it up with regards to the minister. At the General Assembly, the Lord President and two other lords of session, in other words, of the court of session, they came before the General Assembly and told them they should cease and desist, because this was a civil matter, not a church matter. They wrangled back and forth on this issue, and finally, the civil court thought proper to relinquish any further direct interference, but tried the case in their own way and left the church to do the same. This is Hetherington, which seems indeed to be the proper mode of avoiding collisions between coordinate jurisdictions. Right? In fact, their interests were not didn't really overlap. I mean, if the church, all that they would have done would, if the minister had been guilty of the suborning of perjury, they would have disciplined him, deposed him from the ministry. Right? And he still could have been tried, and still would have been tried by the civil court on that charge. Vice versa, if they declared him innocent, it didn't prejudice the civil court's case. Okay, I've got a note here. I almost hesitate to bring this up, but just as an aside, about the same time period from the time that James returned from he returned from Denmark, went to Norway, and then traveled to Denmark, then came back. From the time that he returned, for some time after that, he had a very serious interest in witchcraft, not in doing it himself, but rather in finding out witches and so on. Actually, what had happened was that there was a lot of witchcraft going on, and when you have basically, whenever that happens, these sort of outbreaks, then sort of witchcraft hunting or witch hunters are bound to follow. And they use many of the sort of discredit means that we would think of as discredited to hunt witches and to extract confessions from them and so on. But I guess part of the reason I bring it up, I was in Massachusetts last week, you know, where there's this big thing about the Salem witch trials, which were roughly at the same time. Well, James was, you know, extremely interested in this and actually sat in on some torturing sessions and so on, and made suggestions as to how to get the truth out of these people. What may have particularly piqued his interest is that there was some of the stories were that there was witchcraft being used to get rid of him. So, anyways, it's fairly interesting. At the same time, the Earl of Bothwell, okay, not the old Earl of Bothwell who went off and died insane in a prison in Denmark, his successor, who I think is his son, but I guess I'm not don't know for sure if it is or not, was quite a character, and he really terrorized James. He was somehow implicated in using a sorcerer, although whether or not this is actually true, I don't know. But he had no respect for James at all at one point. James liked him early on, but then he found this guy wasn't afraid of James, and he often sort of did his own thing, including there was a murder of the Earl of Moray. Right? Now the last Earl of Moray had been assassinated, the good regent. Well, this is the son of the good regent. He was murdered by a Catholic noble, I think, as I recall, the Earl of Huntly. Maybe not personally, but I think that's the tie-in. Anyways, Bothwell, for some reason, was going off and going to revenge this crime. And Well, there's a long story where he was put in prison and he escaped, and he kind of came and went through Edinburgh as he chose, and James was apparently quite afraid of him. But, okay, well, anyways, that's just sort of an aside. Maybe more to do with the witchcraft thing, but... okay, with the king looking on the church still with comparatively good favor, it was thought to be an opportune time to reverse some of the Black Acts of 1584 and some of the problems that they had. So the General Assembly met on 22nd of May, 1592. They drew up a list of requests. When Parliament met in June, they took up the request and they passed an act, sometimes called the Golden Act, in contrast with the Black Acts. And let's see, Hetherington calls it the Great Charter of the Church of Scotland. And writing, even in the 19th century, said that a lot of the church's liberties are based on this particular act. Okay, the provisions included a number of things. It recognized, or in the words of the act, ratified and approved the General Assemblies, Provincial Synods, Presbyteries, and Kirk Sessions as legitimate, and their discipline as legitimate, approving their meeting once each year or as needed, for the General Assembly twice each year for synods, and meeting frequency for presbyteries and Kirk Sessions were not specified. There was a catch here, right? And so as long as the king or his commissioner was present in the town when the assembly was held, or particularly when the assembly was ended, they would appoint the time and location of the next assembly. If neither was present, then the church could do it. So early on, it wasn't a big deal, right? As long as they were there, and it was just a matter of setting the location, the time for the next meeting, it was no big deal. But James later used this to prevent the General Assembly from meeting at all. Okay, the Black Acts weren't completely repealed, but a lot was given up. They shall no way, let's see, this is a quote from the Act, they shall no ways be prejudicial nor derogat, I didn't translate that, anything to the privilege that God has given to the spiritual office bearers in the Kirk concerning heads of religion, matters of heresy, excommunication, collation or deprivation of ministers, or any such censors, especially grounded in having warrant of the Word of God. So, in other words, instead of saying that the bishops were the, which is what the Black Act said, the bishops were the ultimate authority for ecclesiastical matters, it says here specifically the church office bearers are, not the bishops. It repealed some Catholic acts previously enacted. It annulled the Black Act that granted commission to bishops and other judges constituted in ecclesiastical causes to reserve His Highness's presentation to benefices, to give collation thereupon, and to put order in all causes ecclesiastical. So, sort of the opposite of what we just read, or the negative. So it really puts the spiritual authority back in the hands of the church officers. The second book of discipline was not explicitly ratified, although some of it was implicit in the act itself. There were some issues left unresolved, and that included the property that had been annexed by the crown. The present situation was that the king held the properties and that he could use the income from thereof to pay bishops or whoever. Wasn't a final solution. Payment of the ministers. The ministers were still very poorly paid because of this sort of inadequate funding system where they took a lot of the tithes and so on and used them for other things, they being the nobles that had control over who got the benefices. Also, representation in Parliament was not settled. And historically, the Scottish Parliament... The Scottish Parliament had been made up of three estates, the nobles, the representative of the burghs, the larger cities, and the church. Right? And the basis of the representation wasn't perfectly clear. In fact, I think a quote from McCree at the beginning sort of supports this idea. Let's see. This is about the Act of Annexation. It virtually divested the bishops of the right to sit on the national judicature, which is founded on their baronial possessions. So if that's the basis of it, the reason they're in Parliament is because they own this property, then of course once all their property is annexed, then they don't have any business sitting in Parliament. That's not necessarily the case. It may have been that they were the basis was their sort of spiritual authority, but it's not really spelled out, and it's something that because the underlying situation had changed over time, that there was no... the further basis, what to do next, was sort of unclear, and it wasn't settled by this bill. Okay, we'll stop there. Questions? Dr. Reese. Yes.
Didn't the church have a bit of a full case of Alvin and Lee's annexation? Because basically they've taken over all the churches and properties from the Catholic Church.
Well, right, they saw themselves as legitimate, in a sense, they saw themselves not as a different church, but as the same church reformed. But in fact, right, the way things were, I mean, that was the original claim, and I haven't read anything to indicate they were still sort of pressing that claim. Right, I think they'd given up on it, and several people think that they actually encouraged this annexation because it sort of eliminated, I mean, think about all the problems they've had with bishops. Well, a lot of the problems are related to the money involved. Right, that some noble wanted to get most of the money from some of this property being rented out and so on. So he appointed, quote, you know, he appointed a bishop and he gave the bishop with some agreement that the bishop would get a small salary. Right. And so, from that sense, it was one of the causes of contention in the act of annexation. Probably did eliminate it. So, yeah, I don't know, Simon. In any case, the upshot was that they never were able to press that claim. So, Mike?
Just really two questions. You didn't mention the new claim that you had behind the golden bird. And the second one is, if you had, I don't know, how was it that your landlords were there? You know, it seems to me that they were fighting back and forth about getting the money. It seems to me that they own land, they can tax.
Well, it's this feudal system. So a lot of these feus, F-E-U, plural, feus, were actually long-term rental agreements, like long, long-term, generational type rentals or longer. So they were legally bound. They couldn't just necessarily change the agreement. James himself was often sort of not in poverty, but didn't have money to run his operation. And of course, part of that was because he gave stuff away, right? I mean, you recall when he received from Morton these estates of the Hamiltons, he immediately gave a bunch of it away. I think there's actually a story later in life that James commanded something to be given away, and his chancellor or somebody had it all put into like coin and show it to him. I can't remember that story exactly, but you know, he was sort of very free with his money, and then he never seemed to have any. So,
and how was the gal?
I guess okay so far. I mean, they had a number of children. Vicky knows how many children they have. 11 or something. So, she wasn't. I don't know all that much about her. She said not to be particularly bright. But she could be neurotic. But beyond that, she obviously bore a lot of children. So.
Now, just at this time, when trying to get this time frame. The idea of law being over the kingdom instead of the king over law.
Uh-huh.
How long has that been going on? Like you said, the landowners are bound by the civil rights when they just break them and they are the big dogs. And
well, they did sometimes. I mean, they usually came up with ways to do it. So, sometimes just killing people. Yeah. How long has this idea? Yeah, well, of course, the book Lex Rex hasn't been written yet. It's still, I don't know, 40, 50 years in the future. I really don't know the whole history of the idea. In Scotland, it's clearly been around since the Reformation, so say since 1560, that when the church started having to write up, formalize its doctrine. The idea that the law is over the king had been around. James, of course, never accepted this idea. I mean, you could, in a sense, say that James and his sons and grandsons were sort of the last in the West, were the last sort of true holders of that view. I mean, So Charles I losing his head over it. James II, James's grandson, eventually being banished or exiled from the kingdom. So, I don't know. I mean, the idea of laws over the king is still contested today, right? With our current president likes to think that he's above the law.
So.
And he is. He gets away with this. So. What's that? So far, yes, so far. Never mind. Well, I saw this week that, he's up for being disbarred from the bar, so there's some... He's been threatened with being disbarred, so he wouldn't be able to serve practice as a lawyer. Not that that would make much difference to him, but it would clearly be a blot on his character if he was disbarred. So he's apparently filed their reply, and we wait on events to see what happens. But, what's that? Yeah, this is all on the tape. So. It doesn't. It goes through like the court there. I'm not in Arkansas. So.
Police show up real early in the morning there, drawing automatic weapons.
They'll deport the guy who's getting the side. Yeah. Okay. Any other questions or discussion? Okay. Dan, would you close us in prayer?